Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to episode 63 of Minnesota Sports Weekly. I'm your host for the night, Travis Elney. I'll be joined by my co-host, Chad Smith. And we got a great show for you tonight. We got Dan Hayes of The Athletic to talk about the Twins. We have Tom Schreier from Zone Coverage to talk about the Timberwolves and their battle for the playoffs. We'll be joined by Heather Rule to talk about the Wild playoff chances and preview the Twins. And finally, the interview I'm really excited about is Ryan Burns of Gopher Illustrated, and he's going to talk about how spring practice is going for Gopher football. So without any further ado, I'm going to bring on my co-host, Chad Smith. Chad, how's it going tonight?
Good, my friend. How are you?
It's going good. The first thing I wanted to ask you to get started is the Gophers hired a new Gopher after 19 years. Don Lucia resigned as Gopher hockey coach, and he was replaced with Coach Mosco from St. Cloud State. So, yep. What's your thoughts on the hire?
Well, the first thing I want to say is this. The Timberwolves conversation is going to be interesting. And you and I signed an agreement before the show began between each other that we were not going to talk about that Memphis game, right?
Never.
No, we're not covering the Memphis game. So, Timberwolves fans, we're sorry, but let's move on. I'm thrilled by this hiring. And I have to be honest, Travis, I really thought there would be one more year of Don Lucia. But evidently, it was past time to make a change. Mosco, 57 years old, high energy guy. It disappoints me to a certain extent that one of the big factors in all of the news coverage is he's not a U of M graduate, and that really doesn't make me happy because who cares? This guy is a great hockey coach. Look at the dynasty he's built at St. Cloud State. He was one of the chief assistant coaches during their championship run from 2001 to 2005. Kind of Don Lucia's right-hand man, according to everything I've heard, everything I've read. And I was watching Gopher hockey every day back then because it was really can't-miss hockey. So there's a lot of work to do to rebuild that program. You and I had talked earlier, I took my son to the game with the Army Black Knights, just shocked at how many empty seats were in Mariucci Arena, and that's one of the first things I'll have to get turned around.
Yeah, I was saying that the Gopher job is one of the elite jobs in college hockey, that and probably UND. Or UND, there's a few
big time
jobs that are still big time jobs, and University of Minnesota is still a big time job. So, do you think it's going to take a while for Coach Mosco to turn it around, or do you think he can do it pretty quickly?
I think he can get it turned around. I wouldn't surprise me if it took a year or two to get the ball rolling in the right direction. Smart guy. He knows the game. I think he's the thing that he has going for him over Don Lucia. Don's a nice guy, okay, but he's not a salesman. He doesn't interact with people outside of the program very well. You've heard his interviews just like I have, you know, short, clipped, to the point. Mosco's engaging. If you watch him with his, you know, players on the side during a hockey game, always talking, always coaching, teaching. there were stretches of Gopher hockey games where it looked like Lucia wasn't even paying attention. Obviously he was. What I'm saying is he's just not as expressive as Motzko is, and I think this is the right guy to inject a shot of much needed energy into a program that, you know, I hate to say it, it had kind of gone stagnant. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's important to turn this program around, and it will be interesting to see how that goes. With that being said, we got a full show ahead of us, so we need to move on.
I want
to bring on Ryan Burns from Gopher Illustrated, and he'll be talking about Gopher spring football. Our next guest on Minnesota Sports Weekly is a friend of the show. He's been on a few times from Gopher Illustrated. It's Ryan Burns. Ryan, how's it going?
It's going well. How are you guys doing today?
Good.
Excellent, excellent. I'm going to start off with a question that I have. Is after it came out that Shannon Brooks was going to miss 2018, who are some of the guys in spring ball that look like they could be taking on the role of taking some time as a backup behind Rodney Smith?
Yeah, the running back situation for Minnesota going forward this season is going to be very interesting to watch. You mentioned that, unfortunately, for Minnesota, Shannon Brooks goes down with an ACL tear. He has already had surgery, so hopefully that means he's going to be ready to go next year for spring ball. But no Shannon Brooks, which means, again, he took 30% of the carries last year, and then that three-headed monster that Minnesota had with Kobe McCrary, who's now graduated, you can't put it all on senior Rodney Smith. And so when you look at some of the names to watch here going forward, I think the first one that comes to mind is redshirt freshman Mohammed Ibrahim, someone that P.J. Fleck has talked up a few different times already here with the media. He's someone that not exactly huge in stature, probably 5'8", 5'9", but 210 pounds. He's a very aggressive north-south runner, someone that isn't afraid of contact. But I also think we need to be talking about guys who are going to be here in June, and Nolan Edmonds and Bryce Williams. Minnesota signed two of the top 25 running backs in the country, according to 24/7 Sports. And I think a guy specifically like Bryce Williams from Sarasota, Florida, turned down numerous SEC offers to come play at the University of Minnesota. I think he and Nolan Edmonds from the state of Georgia are going to have opportunities to come in and compete right away.
Bernsey, I was kind of wondering, what you just said turned down several SEC offers to come to the Gophers. How good does that feel as someone covering the Gophers on a daily basis to be able to say, hey, this guy turned down the SEC to come here?
Yeah, it's a different feeling. I can assure you that. I've talked about it a few different times at Gopher Illustrated, but when you kind of go into a P.J. Fleck recruiting era now, you know, with Jerry Kill and Tracy Clays and, you know, what they did to rebuild the program, they were beating out teams more times than not, like SMU, Western Kentucky, and now we're talking about guys like P.J. just signed, like Bryce Williams. He had committable offers from, I believe, Texas A&M and South Carolina. You look at Rashad Bateman, the wide receiver who's going to, in my eyes, immediately have to play from day one, turns down Georgia, from the state of Georgia, Tennessee, Texas A&M, amongst, I think, two other SEC teams. So it is more exciting. And then that, you know, it's a lot more, I guess more fun to cover. Again, you're in battles that I'm not used to seeing Minnesota in battles for. Or even a guy like Daniel Fa'alele, who's already on campus, the Australian monster, 6'9" and a legitimate 390 pounds. We're talking about a guy who took official visits to Alabama and Georgia in November, and then he ends up signing with Minnesota in December. I mean, they're competing with two teams that just competed for a national championship. So, again, I know there's a lot of talk amongst, you know, people in the football community, you know, stars don't matter. Well, I think stars may matter when Ohio State and Georgia and Alabama are consistently in the top five of recruiting rankings every year, and they're not signing these 2- and 3-star guys. So, P.J. was able to sign the highest-rated recruiting class in the internet era for Minnesota, which is in the last 18 years. So let's hope that he's able to continue that success going forward and that translates to wins at TCF Bank Stadium.
All right, now the monkey in the room that's been a problem for quite a while, the quarterback position. You have Victor Viramontes coming in, then you also have Tanner Morgan. And well, how's the quarterback situation looking this spring?
Well, to me, it's a clear two-guy race between redshirt freshman Tanner Morgan. Again, for those who don't remember who Tanner Morgan was the first commitment that P.J. Fleck got when he came from Western Michigan to Minnesota. Tanner was supposed to enroll at Western Michigan in 48 hours' time, then P.J. gets the Minnesota job. Tanner enrolls at Minnesota site on scene. He goes through his redshirt year, and now he looks like he's ready to compete. He looks like he's probably put on 10 pounds of muscle, something that he needed to do. But he has been in control of the ones. He has been the starting quarterback for Minnesota right now. He's been getting talked up by P.J. Fleck for making some impressive throws. Now, today will be the first day that the media is going to be able to see the team portion, so I'm excited to see what Tanner looks like in 7-on-7 and 11-on-11. But I can absolutely see why P.J. has been talking him up just from what we've been able to see in the media. He is a leader. He's someone that's being able to make these tough throws, you know, whether that's from hash to hash or down the field. I think Tanner's done a good job. It should be no surprise that Victor Viramontes, again, for those who don't know, the top-rated junior college quarterback in the country, last class, according to 24/7 Sports, is behind Tanner Morgan right now, because Victor's only been here about 2 months. And, again, when you look at the track record for Minnesota and junior college guys, I mean, you look at somebody like Damian Wilson. He is now the starting linebacker for the Dallas Cowboys. When he came to Minnesota, he was not a starter until just a week before fall camp, and he was an early enrollee as well. So it's going to take some time for Victor to get into the system, but I do anticipate when fall camp comes and Kirk Shiroka, Minnesota's offensive coordinator, starts to really look at this race, you know, I anticipate it being a good race, and that's exactly what you want at the quarterback position. It's something that Minnesota hasn't had, is that competition. Because competition amongst one another really drives you to come to whatever it is, weightlifting, off-season workouts, or even practice, and do your best knowing that some guy is breathing down my neck, and if I don't bring it today, I might get passed. So if they're pushing each other every day, it only can be really good things for Minnesota's offense in the short and the long term.
What do you think, Burns, about the competition? What certain skills will these guys have to show as – you know, the off season goes on, gets into training camp. What are some of the skills that are going to put them over the top in the race for the number one job?
I think the first thing that Kirk Shiroka will probably take a look at is, you know, how well can he run this, what they want to run in terms of a run pass option system. Now, I know there was a lot of talk throughout the playoffs that that's what the Philadelphia Eagles are running. Now, did they run some concepts with that with Nick Foles? Yes, but I mean, you got to see it with Carson Wentz, where you really have to kind of honor the quarterback, the running back, and then the wide receivers running those quick routes to where if you don't respect one of them, the offense is going to take a hold of it. So I think when Minnesota kind of gets down to it, you have to be able to see how well each can run it. Again, in running the ball, you know, probably where Viramontes has an edge because he is a thicker guy, probably 6 foot one, 225 pounds. He did rush for over 20 rushing touchdowns last year at his junior college. But in that same respect, if neither quarterback can really take care of the ball, it's going to be an issue. And so that's where I also come back to Kirk Shiroka's offense is predicated on the quarterback making smart decisions with the ball. And you saw the quarterback play for Minnesota, specifically Demary Croft, he had issues with that. Now, Pro Football Focus rated Demary Croft as the second worst quarterback in the country last year. You know, maybe that's fair, maybe that's unfair, considering that, again, that was Demary's first experience. You know, didn't have a ton of reps. But the issue was his completion percentage was low. He had more turnovers than touchdowns. Again, things that you don't want to see. So now you have two guys coming in. And again, folks need to remember, whoever the starting quarterback is, Tanner Morgan or Victor Viramontes, Minnesota will not have a quarterback on the roster that has thrown a Division I pass in the forward direction. So whoever it is going to take some lumps. And that's where this entire offense as a whole, I see it, as there's going to be a lot of lumps taken because we talked about running back already. You know, Roddy Smith has a ton of experience, but they also need to get somebody's feet wet, whether it's Muhammad Ibrahim, whether it's Bryce Williams, Nolan Edmonds. You look at a wide receiving core that desperately needs somebody to step up because, again, if Victor Viramontes or Tanner Morgan have a clean pocket, they need somebody to consistently get open besides Tyler Johnson. So the quarterback position is something I don't think is going to be decided well into fall camp. But if they're able to take care of the ball, if they're able to run Kirk Soraka's system effectively, and again, I'm a big proponent of you fit the players to the scheme and not the scheme to the players. And I think that Kirk Soraka is smart enough to do that, because maybe if Tanner Morgan wins the job, you do a little bit less running. Maybe if Victor Villamontes wins the job, you kind of tune that more to his skill set, to where defenses are really going to have to key in on Victor, maybe a little bit more than Tanner. But it's going to be something that really does come into fall camp.
Let's talk about a little bit on the defensive side of the ball. The defensive tackle, you got O.J. Smith into the program. I know he transferred, but they have quite a few young defensive tackles. How much improved do you think the whole defensive line is going to be this fall that you've seen?
Yeah, you mentioned it. There's going to be some depth issues, I think, on the defensive line, because you look at defensive tackle this year compared to last year, while Minnesota's now losing Steven Richardson, Merrick Jackson, Andrew Seltzer, all to graduation, and they're only returning Gary Moore. So I think that Gary is probably going to be a starter, along with, as you mentioned, Alabama defensive tackle transfer, who's now eligible, O.J. Smith. Again, I think you'll see O.J. Smith as that one technique, that A-gap kind of plugger. He is enormous. I mean, he is a legitimate 350 pounds. Now, maybe he needs to continue to get into better shape so he can play more than 50% of the snaps, but he is someone that can probably allow Gary Moore to do work. Now, Gary Moore was brought in by Jay Sabo and Tracy Clays on that defense, and Gary has flashed at times, but he hasn't really got an opportunity to really play a majority of the snaps because of the aforementioned guys, the Steven Richardson, the Merrick Jackson. So I think those two are going to be counted upon heavily. Then you also have a junior college transfer coming in who just redshirted this past season on the all-name team in Royal Silver III. Not every day you get to be able to pronounce that. So I think he's going to be counted upon. Then Minnesota's going to have some redshirt freshmen and likely some true freshmen coming in, because they have a guy from Chicago coming in by the name of Elijah Teague. I was able to see him in camp when he was only a sophomore. And frankly, he put on the most impressive board drill I've seen from a defensive lineman in my 8 years covering those Minnesota camps. I mean, he was extremely physical, knew how to play with leverage, and he had great hands. And so I wouldn't be surprised at all to see a guy like Elijah T come in day one and play. But Minnesota's going to have, O.J. Smith hasn't played a snap of football in a meaningful game in 2 years. Royal Silver III hasn't played a Division I snap as he redshirted last year. And then we're talking about redshirt guys who just redshirted the previous year, true freshman. So, again, it's going to take some time there. But on the outside, I think that's where Minnesota can be better than last year. Now, Carter Coughlin, the Eden Prairie standout, was Minnesota's best edge rusher last year, whether you look at sacks, whether you watch the tape, or whether you look at the amount of pressures that he was able to get on the opposing quarterback. Now, he's going to rotate between that rush defensive end spot where Minnesota has a stand-up guy there that's trying to come off the edge and gain pressure, or hold the gap for the linebackers to come off the outside. So Carter's going to kind of rotate between there and linebacker. And then Minnesota's also going to be counting upon another redshirt who I've heard good things about for 6 months. He's someone, again, on the all-name team. He's from Indianapolis by the name of Ezi Owatumu, someone that is a legitimate 6'6". He has put on 30 pounds of weight. He's really started to fill out that frame. He's got great length. So he has already – he's Minnesota's starting defensive end. So, again, there's going to be some inexperience on this defensive line, but I think they have the talent to hopefully in the interior be as good as they were last year, and then on the defensive end spots, continue to gain pressure, then hold the edge against the run.
Inexperience on the D-line, as you were talking about, what about the linebacking core behind them? Is there some returning experience to help point those guys in the right direction maybe?
There is. This is the spot I probably feel best about right now from what I've seen in spring practice is that linebacking core. Now, it's likely going to be an all-Minnesota linebacking core because you have Burnsville's Kamal Martin going into his junior season. You also have Robbinsdale Armstrong's Thomas Barber, who was very, very good for Minnesota last year. Someone that Pro Football Focus had one of the best linebackers in the country. And now Thomas is going to be your Mike linebacker. Kamal's going to be your outside linebacker. And then you can mix in the two Eden Prairie stars in Carter Coughlin and then Blake Cashman. So, again, you're looking at three juniors and a senior in that linebacking core. Now, if they all stay healthy, I feel really good about it. But the issue is there is some depth that needs to be filled in behind them. Now, again, Minnesota is a base nickel team, which means they only really have two linebackers on the field at a time. So, in theory, that's your two deep between Kamal and Thomas and then Carter and Blake. But I know that I've seen good things from early enrollee from this 2018 class by the name of Thomas Rush. Thomas Barber thought he was going to play immediately this fall. And I can see why. He's got 6'3". He's got great length, athleticism. For him, it's going to be about how quickly can he assimilate into the speed of the college football game, going from what was a small Ohio town now going against Big Ten speed every day. How quickly can he assimilate to that? Because then, again, it's all about the linebackers for me. It's all about them assimilating to the speed of the game for them to really trust their instincts. So if they, you know, really trust what they see in front of them, then they can go. Now, if he's adjusting to the speed still, maybe they're a half step slow. But I think Thomas Rush can really be a good one. So I feel really good about where Minnesota's at linebacker specifically right now.
All right, Ryan. Let's switch to the offensive side of the ball, the offensive line. They have an influx of talent with Curtis Dunlap, Daniel Paulele, and then Jason Dixon. Last year they brought in Blaze Andrews. How do you feel about the offensive line right now?
Much better than I did a year ago. Now, maybe that's just because the body situation. I mean, last spring ball, I was watching Minnesota with four healthy offensive linemen. They literally could not run 11-on-11 during practice because they didn't have enough guys because of off-season surgeries. Now Minnesota's got enough for a two deep. And you look at this offensive line across the board, I think you have to start with left tackle Donnell Green, someone that I believe is going to be drafted in next year's draft, which is a much-needed ailment for what has been Minnesota offensive line play because P.J. Fleck has talked about it. I've preached to the heavens about it, that Minnesota has not had an offensive lineman drafted in 12 years, which is utterly dissatisfying considering you look east and you look south to Wisconsin and Iowa, and seemingly they have offensive linemen drafted every year, yet Minnesota somehow hasn't had one drafted in 12 years. And I think that's just kind of the epitome of what has been a stalling Minnesota offense for probably the last 5-10 years, and I think it starts up front. And so Donnell is going to be a senior, someone that had a late-round grade on him from the NFL scouts that I've talked to. But, you know, if he plays well as consistently as he did early in that 2017 season, if he puts that into a full senior tape, I think we're looking at potentially a second, third, fourth-round draft pick for Donnell Green. So I feel pretty good about the left tackle there. You have Connor Olson, someone that started every game for Minnesota last year between guard and center as a redshirt freshman. He took his lumps early, but I thought he was Minnesota's most improved offensive lineman as the season went on. He's at left guard now because senior Jared Weiler, someone who was a Remington watch list member going into last season, is at center. And then right guard is where I think it gets interesting because you have Chaskins Bronson-Dovich going into his redshirt junior season, but you also have the athleticism Blaze Andrews, as you mentioned, coming off his redshirt season. The plan for Blaze, from the people I've talked with, is to move him from tackle inside to guard so he can potentially contribute earlier than he would have at tackle right now. So I believe that Blaze is going to ultimately win that right guard job from Bronson-Dovich. Just the athleticism and the length that he has, I think it helped Minnesota a long way at right guard. And then at right tackle, between Meyer Luthra and Sam Schluter, who started a majority of the games in the latter half of the season at right tackle after Red Wings' Nick Conley went down and unfortunately had to retire because of concussions. I think Sam Schluter is absolutely going to be pushed by junior college tackle coming in, Jason Dixon. So I think Minnesota's going to be able to redshirt, fortunately, Daniel Fa'alele, the Australian monster. Minnesota, as you mentioned, already signed and have enrolled Curtis Dunlap Jr., the highest-rated offensive lineman in the internet era to enroll at Minnesota. And then they also have some other offensive linemen coming in. So Minnesota being able to hopefully redshirt them because of the depth that they have built both in the short term with the junior college players and the long term with these guys that they just signed. I feel all right about the offensive line, which is something I haven't been able to say in recent seasons.
Yeah, no doubt about that. It's interesting to me, Ryan, as I sit and listen to you go position by position, just how many Minnesota kids that we've got potentially, bucking for starting time. One of the things PJ said when he took over the job was, got to keep kids, our kids in state. Are we progressing in that direction, obviously?
I believe so. I mean, Minnesota in the last, I think, 4 years has signed the top-rated guy, three of the last four. They signed the top-rated guy in last class in Brevin Spann-Ford from St. Cloud Tech, someone I also think is going to have to come in and play immediately because his skill set is kind of the new age of tight end. And what I mean by that is he is a 6'6", 6'7" basketball player with very good athleticism, very good hands. He's got some of the best hands I've seen from a guy of that size. And while he may not be the fastest guy in the world, and about what I mean by that, he's probably like a 4'9" guy, but he's such a mismatch to what, you know, can be that tight end position. Because if you flex him out wide, he's too big for a corner, he's too big for a safety, and he's too fast for a linebacker. So I think PJ being able to keep some of these guys in is a big deal. And, I mean, you look at this 2019 class that PJ is going after really hard. You look at the two crown jewels, is Quinn Carroll from Edina and Bryce Benhart from Lakeville North. Both offensive linemen. I think maybe Quinn Carroll's future may be on the inside, but again, he is technically the best offensive lineman I've seen in the state of Minnesota. Now, it looks like he may be heading to Notre Dame. He's still going to take all five official visits, but from what I've been told, Notre Dame is the leader, but Minnesota's competing, trying to still maintain that and hopefully be able to earn that. Then with Lakeville North, Bryce Benhart, again, I saw him at practice over the weekend. I mean, he is an absolute monster. He's a legitimate 6'8". He's someone that just took fourth place in the wrestling state. Again, a 6'8" guy took fourth in the Minnesota State Wrestling Championship. It's just crazy to me knowing how, especially in wrestling, the low man wins just with all the different angles and everything. And I love to see that an offensive lineman competes and plays as well in wrestling. So Bryce Benhart is another one to watch. So, again, PJ's done a good job of keeping these good kids in state. And even going forward, I mean, we're talking about a 2020 class that could be, one of the best we've seen in a decade. I mean, Minnesota's already offered multiple of them. We just saw Minnehaha Academy win a state basketball championship. Many of their players on that were starting on that team are very, very good football players as well. So, again, PJ is doing what he can to keep these guys in state because once they stay in state, they tend to do well here for the Gophers.
All right, I got one more question, Ryan, and then I'll let Chad ask the final question, and then we'll let you get out of here. The wide receiver position, everybody knows Tyler Johnson, the most talented probably receiver on the roster. But you also have a lot of talent in Demetrius Douglas, and now they brought in Rashad Bateman. Where's the receiving position right now?
It's probably the position I'm most worried about right now, and not just the wide receiver position as a whole, but just the pass catching. Because, again, whether it is Tanner Morgan or Victor Viramontes, and if the offensive line can give either quarterback enough time, the issue you saw in the Big Ten was that Tyler Johnson could get open, but no one else could get open. And if they could get open, they couldn't catch the ball. I mean, I counted the number of drops Minnesota had in, like, the last five games, and it was something crazy like 18. Now, again, 2 or 4 a game doesn't sound like a lot, but when you're only passing the ball 18 to 20 times a game, that's a huge, huge issue. So it's 3rd and 6, and you have a guy run a 10-yard comeback. The pass is perfect, but he drops it. Drive stalls out. You have to punt. I mean, it's a big issue. So I know what Tyler Johnson can do. I have a lot of faith in him. But then it comes to who can step up. Someone that PJ just talked about last media session was Chris Ottman-Bell. Redshirt freshman that was dealing with a foot issue last year in camp, who I thought he was better than Demetrius Douglas in camp last year, but unfortunately he had a foot issue come up. Someone that can really go up and get those 50-50 balls, of which Minnesota has significantly struggled to get in recent years. I can remember probably on one hand how many 50-50 balls and contested catches that Minnesota's landed in the last three seasons, but that's not a good thing. And so I know that Chris Ottman-Bell can go up and do that. I know that he could potentially be that number two option. You look at Demetrius Douglas, someone that, as you mentioned, started for Minnesota last year before he ultimately went down with a foot injury that cost him his year. We're still waiting to hear back whether he's going to get his medical redshirt. But, again, someone that I think can contribute there. You mentioned Rashad Bateman as well. I have significantly high expectations for Rashad Bateman, more than probably any receiver I've thought of in the last few years off the top of my head, just because I know what he can do, whether it's in the short to intermediate game. But I also think he gives Minnesota that deep speed that can really help Tyler Johnson, because if the safety has to honor Rashad Bateman getting beat on the outside with a fade, and he travels with Bateman deeper down the field, that opens up the short to intermediate game for guys like Tyler Johnson and Demetrius Douglas. So I also think that Brevin Spanford, I already mentioned him, I think he's going to have to play just because his skill set is so unique to the tight end position that Minnesota really needs to get some help with there. So, again, I think you're looking at guys like Chris Ottman-Bell, Demetrius Douglas, Brevin Spanford, Rashad Bateman. I would have included another receiver that Minnesota just signed in Joynell Manns that the Gophers beat out the Badgers for, but unfortunately he tore his knee during a basketball game just a few weeks ago, so he'll have to miss the 2018 season, but those are just a few of the guys off the top of my head.
Tell you what, Ryan, last one for you. You're getting me kind of excited for fall camp already, but lots of talent coming in, but it's young talent. So is this team going to have to kind of learn, feel its way around the Division I football level, at least in training camp and early on in the season?
Yeah, you absolutely read my mind. And this is the biggest thing that I'm trying to stress to people, is it's going to take a little bit of time. I'm already giving them the month of September. I'm probably going to give them half the month of October, because we've mentioned it. Let's go position by position one final time. Is quarterback doesn't have a single quarterback on the roster that's attempted a Division I pass. They're going to have to break in a brand new running back number two and likely number three. They need to figure out who is going to be wide receiver two, three, and four. And at tight end, you don't have Brandon Lingan anymore. He graduated. You don't have Nate Wozniak, who, people sometimes forget about Nate Wozniak. They thought of him as a 6'10". Why aren't we using him in the red zone? He was Pro Football Focus's number one rated run grading tight end of all the tight ends in the country. That's a big deal. Now you're losing him. And so how do guys like Ko Keith, a redshirt that's only played 30, 40 snaps, and then Jake Paulson, who redshirted last season, you're breaking in two brand new guys at the tight end position. Offensive line is a spot where they actually do return some experience for once, which is something that I'm not really accustomed to. We mentioned the defensive tackles. They're going to have to break in two or three new ones there. Defensive end, Ezi Owatumu, has never played a Division I snap. Linebacker, I think they'll be fine at. And then in the secondary, they're going to be likely starting a brand new corner from the University of Florida by the name of Chris Williamson. He transferred last year. He's going to have to play this year. Again, he hasn't played a snap in a couple of years. Antoine Winfield is coming off an injury, so there's going to be some learning curve. Now, again, for me, the wins and losses is just going to come down to how well can this team adapt, because those first few games, I'm anticipating some rough patches. Again, there's a lot of inexperience. I think there's more talent, but there's a lot of inexperience. There's going to be some growing pains as guys adjust to what can I get away with in a game-type setting against legitimate Division I talent. Because you look at the non-conference, we're talking about a home opener against New Mexico State. New Mexico State just won 10 games last year. This isn't a bad program that's coming in like like a Furman or one of the low Missouri Valley schools. This is a legitimate Division I team. So now, should Minnesota still win that game? Yes. Now, I'm not anticipating it being 42-0, but I do anticipate them still winning. So, again, I think Minnesota still has the talent to get to a bowl game this year. It's all going to be about how quickly this talent can get experience and then start playing confident and stop thinking so much, because those first few games, there's going to be a lot of guys thinking, and when you have guys thinking on a football field, it's not a good thing.
All right, Ryan, I want to thank you for stopping on. We'll have to do this again in the fall.
Yeah. Sounds good, guys. Have a great day.
Yeah, you too.
That was Ryan Burns of Gopher Illustrated. And just a reminder, on Saturday, April 14th, will be the annual spring game at TCF Bank Stadium starting at noon. So make sure you get down for that. It should be a fun atmosphere. So to go from the Gopher football to the Twins, as they get set to start their 2018 campaign tomorrow afternoon at Baltimore at 2:10, We were lucky to have on Dan Hayes from The Athletic to talk about the Twins and how they're looking and what to expect. So without any further ado, I'm going to bring on Dan Hayes.
Next up on Minnesota Sports Weekly, let's go ahead and get into baseball as the regular season is officially underway, and we thought we would bring on a guy who knows a little something about baseball. His name is Dan Hayes. He is the new Twins beat writer for TheAthletic.com, and he joins us up next on the show. Mr. Hayes, how are you, sir?
I'm good. It's a little rainy here in Baltimore. I know I'm That wasn't a Counting Crows reference. That's an actual statement. It's raining in Baltimore right now. So
I just got that. Good point. Well, thank you for jumping on the show with us, Dan.
Yeah,
before
absolutely.
Before we talk about the Twins, talk about yourself a little bit. This evidently, according to your Twitter page, not your first gig, and plus you're a heck of an Uber driver too.
Yeah. Well, the Uber driver is by far the best part of my resume. You know, 5 stars, 320 drives. And, no, I'd gotten laid off from my previous job in November, and I needed a way to fill some time. And it seemed like the most logical thing, and it was fun. I was just interviewing passengers for about a month, and it was actually a great way to spend some time and not think about the job market at the time. And before that, I'd spent 5.5 years covering the White Sox. Prior to that, another 5.5 years covering the San Diego Padres, and the opportunity to go to Chicago came up, and it was hard to pass up. So it's been it's cool heading in my 12th season. It has flown by. So yeah.
All right, Dan. Sorry,
I didn't lose you guys, did I?
No. You're still here.
Okay.
Dan, right, this is great. Travis, his partner. My first question for you is, did the decision to send down Zach Granite and go with Ryan Lamar come off as big a surprise inside the industry as it did with Twins fans?
You know what? I mean, as far as talking to scouts, yes. I got the sense probably about 4 or 5 days left in camp. I don't even know that it was necessarily that Granite was over Lamar was a surprise. Maybe even some of the scouts I talked to really like Jake Cave, and they sent him out a few days ago and made it the two-horse race between Granite, Lamar. And, you know, I'd throw a third in there, which was the field. I mean, I think if there had been intrigue on the waiver wire, they were just being flexible with that spot. But I think it's strange in a way. I feel like teams are, especially teams in this spot, are given some creative flexibility to have a feel-good story on the roster when you're talking about the 25th man. And I think Ryan Lamar is kind of that. I mean, I think that they looked at him and said, wow, you know, he's worked to shorten his swing. And then he came out and performed all spring. And it's hard to send a guy home that would hit 475 and with the on-base of 550. I think that it would have been difficult when Zach Granite hit 143. I think he got a hit yesterday to raise it above 150. But, I mean, you know, I think that players were interested. And I think they feel like it's a spot that Lamar can fill the defensive end of it, the defensive component of it, if they need him to. And they're hopeful that he can hit. And you know, it's not going to be a make or break. This doesn't mean Zach Granite won't make an impact on the team. I think Zach Granite has a very good chance of making an impact on the team. It just means he's not on the opening day roster. And so, you know, if it doesn't work out with Ryan Lamar, he could easily be gone in a month. And I think that's one thing that there's sort of like this permanence attached to the opening day roster. Like, it, you know, and of course it means a lot to players to be on that opening day roster, but at the same time, you can still make the biggest impact by going down and spending 3 weeks down there. And that was one point emphasis, was that Zach Granite is going to get every day at bats, and they wouldn't have given him that here, and he would have played sporadically with all the off days, and it would have been tough to kind of adjust to that. So I think they wanted to go with the veteran guy who maybe could do that a little bit better.
Dan, tell us a little bit more about Lamar. You called him a feel-good story. What's kind of been his background in Major League Baseball?
I mean, he said he wasn't even sure. He had had a hip injury last year with Oakland. He thought maybe that was the end of his career. And he talked about wanting to aim for a bench spot and knowing that to come off the bench that he was going to need to be a guy who shortened the swing and geared up, was able to gear up for a fastball because he might get one in that at bat and be ready to hit it. And I think that the way he played, I mean, he played, you know, the effort was there every day. You could tell how much this meant to him. I mean, he nearly lost it three times during a 2-minute interview, talking about the feeling of making the opening day roster. And I think that who he, you know, I think the character he is, it was funny. The players were actively waiting for this too. We were waiting in the clubhouse, and you know, it was me and Rhett Bollinger and Phil Miller, and we're trying to figure out what way they went. We saw Granick get tapped and go into the manager's office, and then we saw Lamar go in a little bit later, but Granick didn't really give any indication. And as he walked by a group in the corner, it was Byron Buxton, it was Miguel Sano, it was Max Kepler and maybe one or two other guys. They were all kind of looking to see what was going on. And Buxton said, hey, you know, and caught his attention as he's walking by. And Lamar kind of looks back and smiles and gives them the thumbs up and then keeps walking to go tell people, you know, tell his family. So clearly he's a guy who has rubbed off well on the players. And he's just been a journeyman and the effort was there and obviously had a great spring. So I think guys were rooting for him.
Cool. Speaking of spring training, I've always been curious about this, about how much spring stats actually matter. A lot of people say that they don't matter at all, but a guy like Lamar, if he wouldn't have hit 475, we probably wouldn't be having this discussion. In your mind, how important are spring stats?
I think only for the fringe guys, really. You see pitchers go to work on, well, we want to hit that quadrant with my four-seam fastball today. So that's what we're going to work on today. And, you know, they go into games with specific targets in mind, and you don't see the whole picture. And I think that's the same for wins and losses. You don't get a chance at the whole picture very often because the whole team doesn't play together as they will start to align, you know, tomorrow at all. You never see that. I mean, even yesterday in the game before, the starters were in there for about 5-6 innings. You had Jose Barrios in there for 3 innings, and, you know, they ran through a bunch of guys in the bullpen. It wasn't like it was a regular game. And so I think that all that matters is individual performance for those guys who really it's make or break. And even then, you have to discount what they're doing, and it's spring training. Some guys aren't going to be around. Some of the pitchers you're facing aren't going to be around at all. So we asked Derek Falvey that today, and he said, look, you have to kind of take it with a grain of salt, but at the same time, if you're seeing the adjustment and you're seeing it work and then he's getting results, it's a good thing. And he said it's more about the process. Is he doing exactly what he wants to do? You know, the results are a byproduct of a good process, but at the same time, they know to take those and kind of distance themselves from it, and they were happy with the process they saw from Ryan Lamar. So, you know, I mean, again, it's a guy who's probably going to see 10 plate appearances in that first month. It's not going to be a big impact, and that's where, you know, you're going to have a bunch of those guys over the course of a year. And I think that they wanted to give him the first crack because he was hot, and he had this new swing adjustment, and it was going well.
Dan, how do you think the roster shook out finally? And I ask that because I have seen a couple of stories on the internet, up and down Twitter, about the fact that there doesn't seem to be a lot of depth in the infield?
You know, I mean, yes and no on that, because I think with you have Adrianza and you have Escobar, you have guys that will fit everywhere. And Brian Dozier is not a guy who's going to be out of lineup much. You're really trying to protect against your third base spot. And with Miguel Sano, and if Miguel Sano's healthy, you don't have to worry about it. If Miguel Sano gets hurt, you're going to bring somebody up anyways. I think they have enough depth to get by. I mean, it's going to be – you've got Escobar who can play a ton. You've got Adrianza who, if he's healthy, can play a ton. And he is the better defensive shortstop. And he has a little surprising pop in that bat. And I think get a better chance to maybe see that some more this year. He surprised a lot of people with the Twins last year with how good of a hitter he was. I think he finished with a 7.07 OPS. And they think maybe there's a little bit more in there even beyond that.
All right, Dan. My next question is, Derek Falvey came out today and said that there's not going to be any negotiations during the season. Are you surprised at all that no extensions got done this spring?
You know, it, not necessarily. You have to have a willing partner on both sides. And I'm sure that just the way this offseason went, it was so strange. And I think that, you know, it doesn't always happen overnight. I think it's a good practice not to have that stuff go on during the season. You really don't want a player distracted. Just to give you an example of how much it can distract a guy in spring training, when I covered the White Sox, Jose Quintana was on the verge of getting his contract extension. And they pitched him against the A's that day, and it was probably mid-March, and he came out and gave up 9 runs, earned runs. That's more than Jose Quintana gives up in 4 starts. And it was just so surreal. And you could tell he wasn't quite himself. And it's because he was thinking about his extension. Yeah. So, you know, that's something that is a good practice not to have it go on during the season. Or if it does, you want to do it very quickly. And maybe without the player knowing much about it until it gets to go time, kind of. It's going to be – you would think that they would have maybe wanted to get a Buxton – and, you know, a couple of those young guys potentially locked up. But, it doesn't always align quite the way you want it to. And sometimes they take a little longer.
Well, you had referred to the offseason. It was a strange offseason, there's no question. Now that we're heading into the regular season, why did it take so long, looking back on it, to get people signed and into camp, Dan?
Yeah, I think if you knew the answer to that and if you could provide it, the Players Association would love it in documented form.
I bet they would.
It was really weird,
yeah.
Though. It made spring training kind of broken up into these different phases when you have, you know, Jake Odorizzi on, I think it was February 22nd or 23rd, and then Logan Morrison right around the start of March, and 2 weeks later, Lance Lynn. It was a very surreal kind of spring to be around. And when you look at the fact that Greg Holland is still out there, someone on the phone here may or may not have taken Greg Holland in a fantasy draft thinking that he'd get picked up and put 30 saves down for some team. It's just been strange. And the Twins were fortunate to be in a position where they could capitalize on it, because not only did they get 3 key guys, potentially a couple of 30 start guys in Lynn and Odorizzi. They got a guy that hit 38 home runs last year and lengthens their lineup. And they did it all they gave up Jorge Palacios, and he definitely has a potential future as a middle infielder, utility guy who could hit a little bit. But when that's what you gave up and you surrendered the 95th pick in the upcoming draft for Lance Lynn, I think you're okay with that, because they've done a great job adding a lot of young talent this last year. Whether it was the draft, whether it was spending the international money after they didn't get Shohei Ohtani to go and get they got David Banuelos and Jacob Pearson, who were both taken in the top 5 rounds of the draft last season, just for that international bonus pool. They signed Junior Severino, who the Braves had lost as part of their penalty for their international violations. They added Jake Cave at the end of spring. They really have done a good job acquiring young talent. And so to give up just those 2 pieces, the 95th pick and Palacios, and to bring in all that they did, it's been a really great offseason. Actually, I'm working on a story about that for either tonight or tomorrow, just about how thorough of a job they did across the board strengthening the organization without giving up much. I mean, they don't have to commit beyond 2 years to any of these guys. Odorizzi is 1 more season beyond this, and Logan Morrison potentially can be back next year, and Lance Lynn's a one-and-done kind of guy. I mean, you didn't put a long-term contract on the books, and yet you probably added about 8 WAR to your roster.
Okay, Dan, my next question is about the pitching staff. They added Lance Lynn and Jake Odorizzi, but they also are hoping that they get back Irvin Santana, and you got Jose Barrios, they're hoping takes that next step. That starting staff, handicap that starting staff for me, please.
Well, I mean, obviously Barrios, you do hope he takes the next step forward, and that's reaching 180 innings and giving you the consistent performance all the way through. And I think they're pretty confident that his off-speed is going to continue to develop further and he can become that guy and pitch deeper into games. And but Lynn and Odorizzi gave you just so much stability that you absolutely needed. I think they have really high hopes for Kyle Gibson, that he is more of the second-half guy. And when he started throwing his four-seamer, I mean, you're talking about a guy that threw his sinker down in the zone for his entire career and then decides, all right, I'm going to start throwing, you know, through the help of the analytics department and the staff scouts, decides I'm going to start using my four-seamer more. And to split the zone that way from the same arm angle and effectively do it is such a good weapon. And we saw him go 6-0 with a 2.92 ERA down the stretch, and it really boosted them. If they get that, you know, something close to that, if they get a 3.50 ERA out of Kyle Gibson in 30 starts, this guy is the limit for this team, because the hope is that you can get Santana back around May 1. Maybe it's going to be a little later. We'll see. But there's not nearly the pressure on him at this point, because they have a solid four to go, and Phil Hughes will come out the DL right around April 11th and be that fifth guy for the spot starts that they need him for the course of the month, and then hopefully that bridges you back to Santana. And, you know, it's not a flashy rotation unless Jose Barrios really elevates this year, and I think he has potential ace in his future for sure. Whether or not he can reach that right now remains to be seen, but it's still a very steady rotation backed by a superb offense and great outfield defense.
Mm-hmm. Can this pitching rotation that they put together, you know, kind of meticulously in the offseason, can it help the Twins keep up with the Cleveland Indians in the Central Division race, you think?
I mean, I think that they're in a much better position to contend with them. I don't know how baseball is going to break. I mean, if the ball keeps bouncing the way it has for them and the Indians don't do as well, I mean, I want to see what the Indians offense what the impact of not having Carlos Santana is on the Indians offense, because I really think he's a guy that, you know, Francona was able to move him around and, you know, he saw a lot of pitches, great on base guy, and that can have a significant impact. But at the same time, the Indians are so good, and their rotation is so dominant, and the back end of their bullpen is so potentially so dominant. I mean, that is the class of the AL besides probably the Astros. And I think that you have to prove it. I think the Twins are in a position where they've given themselves a chance to prove it, and it could be a really fun summer.
All right, Dan. My next question is what – to make of the injury to Miguel Sano, do you expect that to linger, or is that something that's in the past now and he could just focus on cutting his strikeouts down and hitting more home runs?
Yeah, you know, I think at this point it's more going to be, did the lack of conditioning from being immobile, what could that catch up with them? You know, because he's definitely not in – he's probably around where he was at the end of last year, and he's a big guy. As Dad Levine said, he has a generous carriage. And I think that's a great description for him. But they just have to kind of watch with him for the muscle pulls and stuff like that that come with being a bigger guy. But as far as the actual ankle injury, you know, it responded really well, and he was very happy with that throughout the spring. And, I mean, they were talking about at the start of spring, well, we're going to safeguard against him coming back too early and hurting himself, and we're looking more like closer to opening day to him being on the field. And then all of a sudden, March 1, he's on the field, you know, and obviously he was feeling good enough to exceed those expectations by a ton. So it'll be good for him to just get out there and in game. He's not going to be able to lose weight. You just don't, you know, that doesn't happen in this season. But obviously his health is a big thing. I mean, he's never reached the 500 plate appearance mark. If he can, they are in a great position, because he has been crushing the ball all spring. And I know it's spring, but he just looks like he's ready to have a big year. I mean, you can tell that he's gone through a lot this last year. And I know that missing those last 6 weeks of the season hurt him. And so I think he wants to be a big part of this offense. And if he can do that, this team is a much better group.
You know, Dan, you said he's been crushing the baseball. How has he looked defensively in the field? For a big guy, he's always been very surprisingly mobile. Has that mobility returned at all?
Yeah, absolutely. The ball that he comes in on, grabs towards the mound. I've seen that play a couple times. You know, he still can – the stuff that gets back to him and eats him up, you know, he misplays those occasionally, and I think there's some room for that still to be improved. But overall, he's going to – more than make up for, if he is not at least an average defender, he'll make up for that with the bat. And that's the great upside to a guy like him. And that's why you can live with him at third base. I think you stick with him there rather than moving him around. The idea that he's at one spot is really good for him. And I think he makes enough plays to, and then obviously with the bat makes up for it. So he gets a passing grade on the glove side for me, given what he potentially can do with the bat for sure.
All right. A guy I want to ask you about does really well against right-handed pitching but struggles against left-handed pitching. I know in camp he worked with Justin Morneau on hitting things up the middle against left-handed pitching. What is your thoughts on Max Kepler when it comes to what to expect out of him this year?
That's such a difficult process that it doesn't come overnight, and I wouldn't be surprised if we see him struggle early against lefties. I think it's going to be a constant adjustment for him. But I do think if he figures it out that he's got a lot in there and the Twins have reason to keep going with him, because if he taps into that, you know, and I know this is partly an analytics thing, but they believe there's a lot in that tank if he can ever tap into it. And so they're going to continue to give him every chance and exhaust it, because, I mean, we've seen what he can be as a defender. The potential is there. You know, he's hit quite a few home runs for a guy who's young, and that obviously can jump up as he gets older and gets into more of the muscular phase. That just happens with guys, obviously, as they get towards that 26, 27 age. And so I can understand why they're going to keep running out there. I do like that they kind of protected themselves if they need to, with Grossman and Lamar. They have a guy who can come off the bench and hit if it's a dire spot and they don't think he can hit the lefty. You can bring Grossman in, who obviously a reverse split guy, and has always fared well against lefties. And you can go to Lamar, who actually, you know, if he can carry this out, we'll see. But obviously one can fill in for Grossman in the outfield too, if that's the case, where you just pinch hit and platoon. And so they're at least safeguarding themselves against that possibility if Kepler struggles early. And right now, just having talked to scouts that saw him, they didn't see quite the gains, but that's something that you consistently need to see those at-bats anyways. So we probably won't get a good sense for that until he sees a couple lefties in a row during the regular season.
Yeah.
A couple more, Dan, and then we'll let you go. My last question, I was really curious about how Joe Mauer's spring has looked. He had that career resurgence last year. How has his spring gone so far, and what do we expect from him this season?
I mean, I think he got back over that hump last year, and Brian Dozier said it early on that he thought that was just all health, that finally the things that Joe's been working on tirelessly for a few years came to fruition and worked for him. I mean, we saw a huge jump against left-handed pitching again, and it's very possible that's exactly what happened, is that he got healthy. And look, when you have a hitter like Joe Mauer, you don't necessarily your body can slow down, but you never forget how to hit. And I don't think it's the case in either thing here. I don't think he's slowing down yet. I mean, it's possible he's getting to that age 34. But he keeps himself in such good shape that you know that he's doing everything he can to kind of ward off that aging process. And I think it was, for him, very encouraging to see him bounce back against lefties the way he did last year. And, you know, no matter what, he's always going to be a tough at bat in that second spot. And those first two hitters are going to wear down pitchers and set, you know, really set up the middle of that lineup So I think he, you know, his spring was fine. It wasn't anything overwhelming, but it was steady. And you could see him putting together the kind of at-bats he wants to prepare him for the regular season. He's one of those guys where I don't even know if I looked at the numbers, to be honest. I don't, because I just know what to expect from him once he steps in the lineup. And that's a guy that pitchers hate to face.
All right, Dan, last question, then we'll get you out of here. Byron Buxton made some major changes last year, and it seemed to work in the second half. Is this the year that Byron Buxton takes that next step to become the hitter? We know what he can do defensively, to be the hitter that the Twins are really looking forward to.
Yeah, the second half was so dominant for him last year. I think he hit 300, on base was 350, slug was well over 500, and especially the last 2 months. I mean, he was just a force, a dominant all-around force, and I think that was very key for him confidence-wise to kind of struggle the way he did early in the year and then see what it could be like when he bounces back. You know, he didn't worry about it. He learned how to forget about that kind of stuff, and I think he's just maturing as a player as far as understanding what to worry about, what not to, and how to kind of get yourself ready every day and not think about the big picture too much. And so for him to have that sustained success was huge. Now, he's always been a slow starter, and it would be very beneficial for both him and the team to get off to a faster start. But I think no matter what, even if he does get off to a slow start, he knows now how to rescue himself from it, and he's done a lot of good work with James Rouse, and I think that they have him in a really good position going into the year. Whether or not that turns out to be the second half guy, we'll see. It's a question that has to be answered. But if the Twins even got 80% of that second half guy for the whole year, they'd be very happy with it, and we'd be talking about a team pushing Cleveland a lot harder, I think.
That would be fantastic. All right. Listen, Dan, we kept you for longer than we intended, but we really did enjoy meeting you over the phone and talking Twins baseball, and thanks for the insight. I really hope we can do this again sometime.
Absolutely. All right, thanks for having me on, guys.
All right, thanks
all right.
A lot.
We'll talk soon.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, take it easy.
That was Dan Hayes of The Athletic, the Twins beat writer for The Athletic. He had some really great takes on the Twins. So for our next guest, she's going to talk a little bit about the Wild and also the Twins. And she has a different take on things. And I want to bring on Heather Rule. We've had her on before, and she's a great guest. So without any further ado, I'm going to bring Heather on, and we'll get at it. Our next guest on Minnesota Sports Weekly needs no introduction. She's a journalist and author, the Twins Social Network guru. She freelances for The Athletic, Zone Coverage, The Sports Engine, The Star Tribune, and The Pioneer Press, along with ESPN 1500. Heather Rule.
Other than that, she doesn't have much going on.
Heather, how's it going today?
Good. How are you guys?
Good.
My first question for you is, in your opinion, are the Wild going to blow it? They're down to a 3-point.
He's swinging for the fences right away, Heather.
I could certainly see that happening. I'm definitely a little more pessimistic, I think, than some people might be. You know, I was taking a look at some of Bruce's comments from over the weekend and just kind of this whole deal of, hey, we got 3 out of 4 points. And, I think he said something along the lines of just, you know, we're not really tearing things up, but, you know, essentially we're not collapsing either. We're just kind of right in the middle. And just reading it, what he had said, it didn't inspire too much confidence. I think it is a team that we haven't seen, you know, completely swoon this year and collapse, which, you know, has kind of been their MO the past few years. But we've also seen them come down to the wire with getting into the playoffs. That's pretty much happened all the time. So I think it's expected almost. You know, being in the third spot for the playoffs is kind of uncharted territory a little bit. And, you know, with so many other teams in the mix for wild cards and things, you kind of expect that, you know, something's going to go wrong and they're going to blow it somehow.
Heather, what are the current standings? How do they look where the Wild sit right now? And how much time is left?
Yeah, I mean, there's only a few games left. They have, they played 75 games and 82 game season, so there's only a few chances left. They're still in third in the Central. But you know, it doesn't look like they're really going to improve their standings at all. They're, you know, I think only like 9 points back of Winnipeg, but I don't see them overtaking them at this point. And, you know, the Avalanche have been really improved and played a lot better. And, you know, with St. Louis has even turned on the Jets lately too, which is a little bit of a surprise. So I think there's obviously still room for the other teams to come in and overtake them. It wouldn't shock me at all to see them fall into those wild card spots. And even then, I think, you know, it wouldn't be terrible if they, you know, lost out on that third spot and got a wild card. I'm not big on this. Oh, we got to have the correct matchup in the first round for, you know, to kind of increase your odds, because we all kind of saw what happened last year with St. Louis.
Yes, we did.
I don't really put a lot of stock into this, you know, oh, if they match up against Vegas or something, you know, they beat him in the regular season and that'll be good. I don't know if I really buy into that.
Well, we'll just say for argument's sake that the season ended today and the Wild ended up in the third seed and ended up playing Winnipeg. What kind of challenges do you think that series would be?
Do you say what kind of challenges or?
Yeah, would Winnipeg bring the Wild?
I mean, I know Winnipeg has been kind of a big rivalry game for them. So I think from one standpoint, you have the fans and, you know, they travel really well. I think it would be an interesting, just from a matchup perspective, to see, you know, all the Winnipeg fans coming down here to St. Paul and to have a playoff atmosphere. A lot of the regular season games are playoff atmospheres anyway. So, you know, I think that could be tough. I could see it getting in the Wild's heads a little bit, you know, the fans and just kind of the amped up atmosphere of the playoffs. I'm not really sure what, you know, necessarily what challenges from Winnipeg. I look at it more as what challenges will the Wild have to overcome on their side. You know, I think Winnipeg has a lot of talent, and obviously they're going to come out flying and have a physical game, which I think the Wild is, you know, you can get Marcus Foligno out there, you know, he can throw some hits for you and maybe a few other guys too. But I look at the Wild more and think, you know, what do they need to do? Because we've seen the things that they haven't done in the playoffs, and we've seen how they, you know, have trouble finishing at times and, you know, aren't able to you know, have the goaltender steal a game if they need it. So I kind of look at it as more, you know, what challenges are the Wild going to face on their own bench, regardless of the other team.
Into the playoffs, what are your thoughts on how are the Wild going to be able to overcome some of the challenges that you brought up when it comes to the goaltending? Is Dubnyk going to get the start no matter what, or could you see them going with the backup in some of the games?
I could definitely see him turning to Stalock, especially if they get behind in the series. You know, it's always interesting to me how much home ice plays into how people think of the series. And if your team gets down,
you know, even 0-1 or 0-2, you know, people act like the series is just over right away, which, you know, I know statistically it's not a great spot to be in, but I think we put a little too much emphasis on, oh, this is a must-win game. Well, it's only a must-win game if you're, you know, if the other team has 3 wins. But I could easily see them turning to Salak if, you know, if they get down 0-2, regardless of, you know, the opponent or who has home ice, and especially depending on how Dubnyk's played. You know, I don't know if Bruce makes a switch if Dubnyk plays a couple strong games and the team ends up losing anyway for, you know, maybe they weren't finishing their goals, and maybe he only gets up 1 or 2 goals each game. You know, he might stick with Dubnyk then too, because it'd be more of the onus would be more on the offensive players to put the puck in the net. But it wouldn't shock me to see Stalak in there. I don't think it's necessarily going to be Dubnyk all the way. You know, but if they're successful, you know, on the other hand, and they're going to keep going with Dubnyk, with the hot hand, and he has been the number one goaltender all season. I think with Stalak, when you compare to, like, you know, Darcy Kuemper, I think there's more confidence in Stalak, and especially the way they've turned to him on, you know, the back-to-back games this year, and, you know, just other situations where maybe Dubnyk needed a break, things like that. I think they're more confident turning to him rather than before it was, okay, well, we have to go with Dubnyk because we're not really that confident in Kemper's abilities. So, it wouldn't shock me, I guess, either way, but if Stalak's in there, that's not going to be anything that's too surprising. I mean, he has played pretty well for this team when he's been called upon this year.
What kind of a season has Dubnyk had as the number one goaltender so far?
It's been all right. I don't want to say it's anything like award winning. There haven't been a ton of stretches or a ton of games where I think, oh, well, he totally stole that game for them, or he, you know, was really on. He still gives up those goals once in a while where you're kind of looking like, ah, man, that wasn't a great goal to give up. And, you know, but the Wild come back and they score a few goals and they manage to win the game, so it's not looked at as much. But especially in March, he struggled a little bit. And, you know, I think that's concerning. You kind of look at, you know, okay, does the pressure get to him? Does the long season kind of wear on him as being the number one goalie? I think he's still one of the top goaltenders. I mean, he does a great job for the Wild. I think just kind of looking at the team overall and looking at him overall, they kind of go one and the same. You know, he's had a pretty good season, and, you know, the Wild behind him, pretty good season as well. You know, they're in the mix for the playoffs again. So, you know, I think what maybe you're kind of missing is those games that you're not thinking like, oh, yeah, he had like 45 saves and they were all amazing and he had these, you know, shutouts. And, you know, so it hasn't been quite to that level of extreme where you just see him robbing players right and left. But, you know, I think he's done enough to get the wins. You know, he has a lot of wins under his belt this season. And, you know, at the same time, that his teammates have picked him up too, and they've scored goals when they needed to. You know, they haven't had these, you know, 2-1 games all the time. Their offenses has come up big. And then on the other side, you've had the disaster games where they've lost 7-1, 7-2 every once in a while. And those are, you know, those have kind of gotten out of hand. I think that's kind of the blemish and the concern. You know, you hope something like that won't carry over to happen in the playoffs, but I mean, I guess you never know. I think it'd be it would be too bad if that did, because I think those are the big red flags for me this season. And you can tell with some of those games that he was just not feeling it. You know, things were not going well, and, you know, that's where you would see him getting pulled for Stalak.
Last one for you regarding the Wild, and then we'll switch to some Twins talk briefly here on Minnesota Sports Weekly. Tell me a little bit about this Jordan Greenway. Lots of talk about Jordan Greenway signing an entry-level contract with the Wild, an Olympian, and a large human being. Is he going to see ice time for the Wild, I'm assuming?
Yeah, I think so. I was in Fort Myers this past week watching some of the Twins. I watched a couple of Wild games, so I kind of
kind of taking a little break from, you know, some of the hockey stuff, but I did hear that he had gotten the call and wasn't surprised at all to hear that. That's kind of been one of those Jordan Greenway watches for a while now to see when they would sign him. I would definitely expect to see him, you know, suit up for the Wild and really contribute. I haven't seen him play or watched him play before, so I'm kind of anxious to see what he would bring to the table. I know he's been a name that's been thrown around for a long time, and I think fans are really anticipating him to come in and leave a mark with this team. I think he could, you know, maybe bring some of that young energy too. I think sometimes when you bring in a player like that into the mix and they're, you know, excited to be there on, you know, kind of the big stage, and you know, I think that can be a good thing to get someone with fresh eyes, especially this late in the season, to kind of come in and just, you know, maybe they feel the expectations or maybe they don't. Maybe they think, you know, the pressure's off. I'm the new guy. Just kind of come in and, you know, hopefully surprise some people and, you know, just come in and do well and leave his mark. And I think, you know, I think fans are anxious to see him, and I think we'll definitely see him in a Wild sweater.
All right, Heather, just a couple of Twins questions. You were in Fort Myers, you said. Who impressed you when you were watching?
It's interesting. I went to a couple of games, and the first one, they actually had a little bit of a cool front come down there in Florida, which was, you know, 70 degrees is a cool front, and but it was a night game, and it was very windy and cool. It kind of felt like a football game atmosphere. It was really weird. But in the second game I went to, the Twins had a no-hitter going into the ninth inning, meaning that they were getting no hit. So until they had a double and a home run in the ninth inning. So that was a little disappointing, but this spring they've kind of been one or the other. You know, they've either put up 8-10 runs or, you know, they maybe scratched one across. So it just kind of depends. What was weird about that game is, you know, with the past week or so and just the roster movements and things, you're seeing more of the regular players and the regular lineups that they're going to use for the regular season. And so I think that was kind of odd. It was like, well, okay, these are the main guys, and you know, they didn't happen to be hitting that day against you know, against the Astros. It, you know, it wasn't like, you know, some team that hadn't done anything for a while. But I think overall in spring, Adrianza has hit pretty well at the plate, which I think is important with the suspension of Jorge Polanco, that, you know, he's able to be, you know, a backup to Eduardo Escobar now and able to contribute with his bat. So, you know, that was good. We saw Buxton a little bit. Obviously, we know what he can do in the outfield. Max Kepler actually made a pretty good running catch in right field the other day too, which, you know, I think it's important to recognize that it's not just Ivan Buxton in the outfield doing good things, that it's, you know, the corner guys too are making plays. And, you know, Sano, I think he drew a walk, Maurer drew a walk when I watched him. And they're, you know, hopefully they can build on the seasons that they've had. You know, Maurer had a really great season, and there's already been a lot talked about with his, you know, his last year and, you know, the big contract he's had. And, you know, I think he's trying to push that out of his mind. And, you know, the team's really looking to do something this season and get to the postseason and win series. And I think they showed that, the front office showed that with some of their acquisitions too, with like Logan Morrison and Lance Lynn. Lance Lynn was the starting pitcher I saw the other day, and he did pretty well. I think he had a few strikeouts in that Astros game. So hopefully, you know, hopefully it'll all come together. I think fans are really excited about the offseason acquisitions for sure.
What are your last one for you? What are your expectations for the Twins this year?
I'd certainly like to see a first round series. You know, getting to the wild card game is, you know, it's something different. It's something that's only been a few years, you know, in baseball, but I think while it's fun, I mean, it still only is one game then, you know, for that losing team. And so I think I would like to see them get back to the ALDS and make something happen there, you know, regardless of who the opponent is. You know, I'm not sure if a division title is within reach this year. But who knows, because they kind of exceeded expectations last year, I think, and surprised a lot of people. But, you know, I think if things go their way, you know, even getting that wild card game and winning the wild card game and getting to the ALDS, I think would be a pretty big deal. You know, I'm sure the front office has its sights set on, you know, getting to the World Series is obviously the goal for every team. And I think they've kind of shown that again with the signings and these one-year deals. They, you know, brought in some pitching for the bullpen. And, you know, so I can see where expectations might be a little bit higher, certainly. But I think, you know, for me, even just getting back into that playoff series and just having a few games where you know, are facing the same team, and it's the postseason, and really, really exciting and a little more fun than just the wild card game. You know, last fall was exciting for the first little bit, and then the Yankees came right back and, you know, had that free run homer pretty early on, and it was sort of deflating at that point for the rest of the way. But I would hope that they can, you know, hopefully move past that and get into the ALDS.
All right, Heather, I want to thank you for coming on. It's always good to talk with you. We'll have to do this again.
Yes.
All right, sounds good. Thanks for having me on, you guys. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. All right. That was Heather Rule. She is on The Athletic. She is with Zone Coverage, ESPN 1500, and she's also the social media guru for the Twins during their games. So thank you for coming on. Our final guest of the show will be Tom Schreier. He's from Zone Coverage, and he's going to talk about the Timberwolves. So without any further ado, let's bring Tom on. Our next guest on Minnesota Sports Weekly from Zone Coverage is Tom Schreier, and we'll be talking about the Timberwolves with him. So without any further ado, here's Tom. Tom, how's it going?
Pretty good. How are you guys doing?
I'm doing excellent. Thanks for hopping on this tonight. My first question for you is, this team has kind of become a Jekyll and Hyde type of team, where they lose to the bad teams and beat teams like Golden State and some other good teams. If you had to point to what is the reasoning behind that behavior, what would you say?
It's really tough. You know, I just came out of practice today, and I appreciate you waiting on me. I know we were scheduled to go a little bit earlier, but we talked to Tibbs about this and just kind of how they can, looking at it, John Kaczynski in his write-up last night, he pointed out how they'd be like the number three seed if they had won 5 of 8 games against the bottom dwellers in the East, the bottom four seeds, and then they lost to the Suns and now Memphis twice. So they'd be the number three seed if they'd won 5 or 8 of those games, and then the number four seed if they won something like 3. And, you know, Tibbs obviously is very focused on the game specifically against Memphis and pointed out the physicality. And another thing he pointed out is, you know, there's veterans in the league like Gasol who play with a lot of pride. And then, you know, while, and we've talked about this on Wolves Wired, while organizations tank, right? You know, the Knicks supposedly were trying to lose that game that they almost beat the Wolves in, and the Grizzlies probably it's in their best interest to lose that game. The individual players don't, right? If you're a rookie in the league or a young player, you're trying to establish that you belong. If you're a guy that's kind of jumped around a journeyman, well, you might not be on that team next year, and you're looking for a job in the league with a lot of turnover. So when you talk about stuff like physicality, like focus, just the fact that they gave up those 15 three-pointers and kind of the little detail stuff, I mean, that indicates you're overlooking teams. And it's not just Memphis, right? You've kind of alluded to it, but the Atlanta Hawks, the Brooklyn Nets, the Orlando Magic, Phoenix Suns, as I said before. So, you know, when you see lack of physicality, lack of focus, it does look like they're overlooking teams. So Tibbs says he's mentioned this. They do still have teams like this remaining on their schedule. And frankly, they got to win them if they're going to make the playoffs this season.
Okay. My next question is Carl Anthony Towns. It seems like he goes through stretches where he doesn't demand the ball in good positions. And then other times he's just dominant. What's going to be the key for him to taking that next step as a superstar?
No, that's a really good question, especially when, you know, we talk about this a lot. He's really, really got kind of a next gear, which seems incredible, given that he really seems like a generational talent, a guy who's lived up to his billing as the number one overall pick so far. One thing I kind of think, and we've discussed a lot, is, first of all, he has not been available to the media the last 2 days. We were going to talk to him last night. Dane Moore was there covering for us. He was unavailable in the weight room today. He was unavailable as well. I think he has an inclination to kind of do the physical things first. Let's put on weight. I need to be more tough, right? Hey, I'm going to go take some threes and some free throws to make sure that I can get to the line and that, you know, I can knock down those threes when I'm open. My question to him, and just kind of just generally about young players in the league, is how much do they go, hey, I need to look at more film? That's something that kind of sets Jimmy Butler apart. Tyus Jones, I think, is getting in passing lanes because he's looking at film. If you look at these guys in the league, they're not only obviously physically imposing, but those guys are film hounds. They see the little things in the game that, you know, a guy like Tibbs emphasizes, or some of the best coaches in the league emphasize. So if I was going to point to one thing, it's what is his understanding of the game? How much is he looking over that film? I'm sure he's diligent once he's watching it, but, you know, is there another level he can get to there, another understanding of the game? Because physically, I mean, man, I think he can be tough. You're right. He does need to get in a position where he's demanding the ball. And at the end of the day, they should be looking for him too. I mean, you'd think those shots would be pretty high percentage when the ball is in his hand near the basket.
Something I noticed last night when I was watching the game was Jeff Teague played the entire third quarter, and then to start the fourth quarter they went to Tyus Jones, and then like a minute or 2 minutes and they brought Jeff Teague back in. In your opinion, doesn't Tibbs trust the bench, or what's going on with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big issue here is that we talked about early in the season, A, obviously we know Tyus Jones played well when Jeff Teague was out, but B, just generally speaking, you were worried about Tibbs kind of burning out the starters. Obviously, these are high-caliber players. You really trust Jimmy. We know how talented Wiggins is. We just talked about how talented Towns is, so on and so forth. Taj Gibson having a career year. But, you know, the other truth is, yeah, if you don't play Jamal Crawford enough, you know, he really can't get in rhythm and going. Manu Bielitsa looks better now. I know last night he didn't play very well, but generally speaking, he looks better with more minutes. You know, you go on down the bench. I think Tyus Jones is a very good all-around player. I don't think he has the offensive upside of Teague, and you understand why he's in a game like that. I think he played particularly well, and Tibbs addressed that in the post game last night. But yeah, I mean, you not only have to worry about burning out, you know, your starters by playing out too long, but you have to think of how to best utilize the bench. I don't know if trust, I mean, it should not be a huge issue. Obviously, as you get into the playoffs, assuming the Wolves make it this year, which is not a complete certainty at this point, but you would, you know, shorten the rotation. But even if you're only using three guys off the bench, you have to make sure they're productive and that they're getting the minutes they need to do what they need to do, whether it's get in rhythm or just kind of get a sweat going and get, you know, used to the game. It's really hard just jumping off the bench. So, yeah, I don't know if it's a lack of trust or if it's just kind of Tibbs is a guy that wants to win. And I think at times he almost can't help himself where he's like, look, this guy's rolling. I got to keep on riding the hot hand. In terms of the usage of Teague and Ty specifically, I think Teague's a great guy to go in there if you want instant offense. You know, he can generate himself. He can get to the basket. He has a few nifty moves around there, and he's starting to distribute the ball a little bit better. With Tyus, I think he's more of a stopgap. If you really want to kind of shut down certain players, he's definitely a better defensive player, and he's shown that he's capable of being productive when he has starters around him. So I think tracking their usage is a really, really smart thing, and in terms of the bench as a whole, you know, he's just got to kind of find that balance. And you would think at this point in the season, you know, he'd be pretty close in that regard.
Okay. What about Jimmy Butler? Are they expecting to get him back anytime soon?
Yeah, you know, he was actually out practicing today. It was kind of fun. We got to see him and Jamal Crawford compete in a three-point contest. This is something that's happened all year long. You go back to when they were in China, we were at practice right after that, and they were playing one-on-one. Two competitive guys, two veterans. They're very close. Their locker rooms are close, very, you know, right next to each other in the locker room. I think, you know, he's not cleared for contact. There is no timetable yet. Tibbs plays things very close to the belt. This is a guy who really admires a lot of different coaches, but Bill Belichick, you know, stands out to me. He's a guy who grew up in Connecticut in that kind of New England era and area, and he kind of plays like Belichick. He kind of plays everything close to the belt, doesn't say much, doesn't want to give the opponent anything in terms of scouting ahead of time. So no timetable on Jimmy Butler yet, but yeah, he was out there shooting. You know, it looks like he's kind of recovering from that meniscus injury. And I would bet after seeing his expressions kind of late in that game, he's pretty ready to get in there. That's a game, I'll be honest with you. He, you know, Jimmy Butler occasionally takes those over and saves the rest of the guys. I'm assuming he's itching to get off the bench as soon as that knee's healed.
Okay. A little bit more on the positive side. Andrew Wiggins has showed a much more willingness to do other things other than scoring, play defense, rebound. He blocked a few shots. What's been the change in your mind with Andrew Wiggins lately?
Yeah, you know, he's a funny one. Obviously, he's got the big contract that's going to kick in next season. Maxed out as the number one overall pick. I think the thing with him and the big question going forward is he tends to play well when he knows he's the guy. We know that offensively. You talked about his defense. Part of the defense, maybe that he knows he now kind of has Butler's responsibility with some of the best wing players in the league. But I think it's also, you know, he's had another full season to learn. He probably has a better understanding of Thibodeau's system and is thinking less and kind of reacting more. And he has the physical gifts. I think the key for him, obviously, is staying engaged the whole time. And then when Jimmy Butler comes back, figuring out what role does he have. You know, how can he feel like he's an important part of the team, feel like he needs to be engaged the whole time and use his athletics abilities to the max. And I think there's no doubt. I really think he's the best athlete on the team, and I'm seeing what you're seeing. There's a lot of positive from Andrew Wiggins lately.
Okay. I can't pronounce it right.
Nemanja Bjelica.
Yeah. He's have been up and down lately. What does he need to do to be a little bit more consistent in your mind?
Yeah, Nemanja Bjelica, going back to kind of the minutes thing, again, take the Grizzlies game out of it. I think that was just a bad game. He tends to play better when he has a few more minutes, when he's not just a touch, you know, catch-and-shoot player off the bench. I think he offers a little bit more. He struggles guarding fours. He's pretty good at threes. I think he's a guy that maybe, you know, again, kind of like Wiggins, more time in that defense may improve or maybe better than he was early in the season, not just because he's getting more minutes, but because he understands the defense more. In terms of offensively, it just takes those shooters a little while sometimes. I mean, it's great to have guys that, you know, kind of microwave guys like Jamal Crawford, even bringing up Derrick Rose, which I know is obviously a tough topic for some people, and some people are delighted he's here, but just trying to look objectively, that's a guy that can score quickly if he's kind of in rhythm. A guy like Bjelica just needs a few more shots. I really think he's a talented player, and then they should be using his abilities as a playmaker as well. Really good passer, you know, offers a little more than just a pure shooter off the bench.
So, okay, we have like 8 games left or something like that.
Seven, I believe.
Seven games left, and they lead Denver by a game and a half. What do you need to see out of this team? And supposedly an easy schedule compared to some of the other teams, but that didn't really show last night. What do they need to focus on in your mind to get this out and get into the playoffs?
Right. I mean, I think the thing is they you hope that this is a lesson for the team going forward. I mean, you could – I thought maybe the Knicks game put a scare into them. I thought maybe the Philadelphia game, given that this is another young team they can kind of compare themselves to, even though it's East-West. But, you know, I thought maybe something like that was a little bit of a wake-up call. But you can kind of chalk Philadelphia up to a scheduling loss. You know, they had some plane trouble. They got in late. It was a back-to-back on the East Coast, all this stuff. You know, you don't want to come up with too many excuses, but you can see a little bit of a scheduling loss there. This wasn't. You know, they had time for this. And they had, you're right, they have Memphis again. They have Atlanta. They have Dallas. They have L.A. And then I know the Nuggets and Jazz are mixed in there, and I'm missing one team. But, you know, this is an opportunity, A, when it's a team that you should beat. Look, again, what I just said, they got guys on there that are young players that are trying to prove themselves. I'm sure there's some savvy fats mixed in there that have pride. But at the end of the day, you got to beat those teams, and you just got to play them as though you're playing like the Rockets or the Golden State Warriors or, you know, some of the better teams in the NBA. On the flip side, you got to remember when they're in division and in the Western Conference, this is an opportunity to kind of make sure that you sneak in there. Not only sneak in as the 8th seed, but look, if you're playing the 7th seed, Curry may be out that first round. Maybe you get Butler back. Again, not calling an upset, but maybe you can make a series out of that, get a little more experience than just a four-game sweep, which you would think would happen against Houston. And then if you can get into that 5-6, I mean, then, you hope you got Butler back at that point if you're the Wolves. And maybe that's a series you can sneak out a win, even though you don't have home court advantage. I mean, where they place is extremely important in order to place well. They got to clean up against the teams they should beat, and then you got to take.
Just a couple more. Justin Patton with a first round pick this year, and he just got called up. Is there any thought to maybe get him into a game, into the rotation before the end of the year, or is he just there to watch?
You know, it's funny. We talked to Emil Jefferson today. He talked about his experience in the G League, and we've actually sent both Tim and Dane down to Iowa to talk to those guys, see Justin Patton, talk to him a little bit. And we've been tracking his progress from afar, and it is exciting. I mean, he's got this rep as a small player – or a large player with a small man's game, given that he kind of had this growth spurt when he was a young man in his teens. I don't see him playing. I think it's just throwing it, you know, too much pressure with a young player. I know, you know, if there's Wild fans listening, they'll say, well, Jordan Greenway, you know, is going to play in Nashville against the best team in the West or whatever. I mean, it's a little different, two different sports. I think you want that guy probably to start the year with you, have a full offseason under his belt, come out with confidence, not make a mistake in a high stakes game. I mean, I think the prospect of him is incredibly exciting. It's crazy that they got that pick in that trade, although that trade is now looking a little more even maybe than people expected. But still, you get a trade with Jimmy Butler in there, and you can go draft a guy like Justin Patton. You know, he's a wild card. I think he's exciting, but I don't think you'll see him down the stretch.
Okay, my last question for you, and then I'll let you get out of here. It's been a long afternoon for you. Tanking has become such in vogue in the NBA, how teams are tanking. And can you make an argument that the Timberwolves will be better off not making the playoffs if you're going to finish 7th or 8th because you keep that Atlanta pick and the Oklahoma City pick? Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say Dane Moore wrote about this on our site, and there is an argument for it. You just listed the picks and whatnot. I mean, I think it's one of those things where if they miss the playoffs, you know, I think just journalistically you try to look at it objectively and you try to point out, okay, here's the cons. The cons are, again, you're out of the playoffs. You're trying to build a winning culture. They're not, you know, the Wiggins and Towns of the world. They're not getting playoff experience. And then for guys like Teague, like Butler, like Taj Gibson, it's going to be a disappointment, right? These guys are veteran guys. They want, in the primes of their careers, or in Gibson's case, as you get into his 30s, you want to make the most of all your season. I think those negatives outweigh the positive of keeping a few picks here or whatnot. Is it the end of the world? Of course not. But if you're trying to win this or establish a winning culture, if you're trying to get fans to buy into season ticket games or watch your games on TV, get people to buy here in Minnesota to buy into this team again, missing the playoffs really, really hurts you in that regard. I see it a little bit like to compare sports again, like the Twins were, you know, you go into Yankee Stadium, you kind of know what that outcome is going to be, but you can kind of build off that momentum and kind of sell the fans on, look, we're going in the right direction. We got our guys' playoff experience, even if it's in one game. In this case, you have a minimum of four. I think it's really important for Wiggins and Towns to go in there, and I just think it goes a long way to build that culture and to sell people on, hey, we're moving in the right direction. Is it the end of the world? No, but it is a setback in my mind, a pretty major one.
All right. Tom, I want to thank you for hopping on. This is fun to talk about the Timberwolves. We'll have to do this again.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Yep, thanks a lot. Good night.
That was Tom Schreier of Zone Coverage talking about the Timberwolves. And that's going to be a show tonight. My name is Travis Downey. Chad Smith, and we'll be back next week at 6 p.m. So tune in next week. All right, thanks for listening. Good night.